RNE Audio. Descarga la app y disfruta de los programas de RNE y nuestros podcasts originales. Radio Exterior de España.
English Language Service.
For the first time ever, the oldest cookbook in Spain is being exhibited for visitors to learn about the roots of Spanish gastronomy.
The University of Valencia celebrates the 700th anniversary of the Llibre de Sensoví with an exhibition about medieval cuisine in the Iberian Peninsula. Curator Juan Vicente García Marcilla told us all about it.
I think the most important thing I would like visitors to understand at this exhibition is to see the Middle Ages not as a dark and barbaric period, but as a very sophisticated moment of history.
You're listening to the English language broadcast of Spanish National Radio, where we bring Spain to you through shortwave with Amy Egan
and Marilyn Quintana. Today we have help from sound technician Elias Curí
and production help from Cristina Dorado.
Before we get into the rest of the broadcast, the news.
The European Summit, celebrated this weekend in the UK, concluded with the announcement of a voluntary coalition to develop a peace plan for Ukraine.
The coalition will be led by the United Kingdom and France. Its objective is defending Ukraine, guaranteeing its sovereignty and security. The countries that will participate in this coalition have not been announced yet, but host Keir Starmer added that these discussions are on the basis that the United States will collaborate with Europe for the development of this plan.
Europe must do the heavy lifting, but to support peace in our continent and to succeed, this effort must have strong US backing.
After the tense meeting with US President Donald Trump,
of the war,
you're not
Mr.
in a good position.
You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards.
Right now, you don't. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calls for diplomacy to achieve peace with the collaboration of Europe and the United States. Europe's proposal includes more financing for Ukraine, increasing economic pressure on Russia, and defending the inclusion of Ukraine in any peace talks. The plan also includes a one-month truce before the deployment of European troops to safeguard a possible peace agreement.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez was present in the summit and showed his support for President Zelensky. Asked about the deployment of Spanish troops in Ukraine, Foreign Affairs Minister José Manuel Álvarez responded saying that it would not be a problem.
Yo lo que creo es que en estos momentos el esfuerzo de que conseguimos
But right now the effort is political and diplomatic, an effort to make sure that we achieve just and long-lasting peace and not just a ceasefire, he said.
In the Middle East, Israel has blocked the entry of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip after the expiration of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement. The Israeli government assures that this measure has the objective of preventing Hamas from stealing resources.
Negotiations for the second stage of the ceasefire were halted after Israel's proposal of extending the first stage for 50 days while the exchange of prisoners continued. Hamas rejected this proposal.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened to take more measures if Hamas does not release the hostages.
We will take further steps if Hamas continues to hold our hostages. And throughout this, Israel knows that America and President Trump have our back. Thank you again, President Trump.
Organizations warn about the consequences of preventing humanitarian aid from entering the Strip and call it a collective punishment that could worsen the shortage in Gaza.
Back in Spain, King Felipe VI was in charge of inaugurating this year's edition of the Mobile World Congress. He took the opportunity to send a message to Ukraine.
Quiero enviar, por tanto, una vez más y desde esta gran cita mundial, nuestro coherente y sostenido mensaje de solidaridad y apoyo.
I want to send once again and from this global event our coherent and continued message of solidarity and support, backed by words and actions to the Ukrainian people in their legitimate defense and their aspiration of reaching a just and long-lasting peace.
This year's edition of the Mobile World Congress is expected to receive more than 100,000 visitors, and the main theme will be artificial intelligence. Among the more than 2,700 companies attending, we find Telefonica, Apple, Meta, Samsung, or Microsoft.
In Los Angeles, Anora became the winner of Oscars night with 5 awards including Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Original Script and Best Editing.
This film was made on the blood, sweat and tears of incredible indie artists and
long live independent film. Yeah, okay, thanks.
Spaniard Carla Sofia Gascón did not walk the red carpet, but she did attend the gala. After all the controversy surrounding her discriminatory post on social media, she left empty-handed for her role in Emilia Pérez. Her scene partner Zoe Saldana did receive the recognition for Best Supporting Actress, and the song El Mal won the Oscar for Best Original Song.
No Other Land is the Palestinian documentary about the devastation caused by Israel in the West Bank and the expulsion of Palestinians. It won the award for Best Documentary.
Can't you see that we are intertwined? That my people can be truly safe if Basel's people are truly free and safe? There is another way.
Adrian Brody received his second Oscar for Best Actor for his role in The Brutalist, and the award for Best Supporting Actor was given to Kieran Culkin for A Real Pain.
You are listening to Radio Exterior de España.
The global stage has been degrading gradually over the past decade, especially with the recent developments between Ukraine and Russia and Israel and Gaza taking up a lot of the air in the room. Last week, however, Afghanistan had a stage of its own in Madrid for the 12th round of the Herat Security Dialogue, held by the Afghan Institute for Strategic Studies. The conference, titled Reviving Hope, Synergetic Efforts, revolved around the rise of terrorism, the political landscape, and of course, the situation of women in Afghanistan.
Yes, there is a global rollback on the rights of women and girls, but nowhere is it as extreme as the situation in Afghanistan.
That's Richard Bennett, the UN's Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan. This idea, the idea of a global rollback on women's rights, was one that permeated throughout the many conferences, of course, with the situation in Afghanistan being a horrific extreme. The Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan 4 years ago in 2021, after 20 years of insurgency. In that time, they have ordered so far 221 decrees, 138 of them directly focusing on women's rights, banning them from society. Others indirectly affect women, with actions such as the dissolution of the Ministry for Women's Affairs. In Afghanistan, under the current Taliban rule, women are banned from studying in secondary schools and universities, and are not allowed in public spaces. They're also banned from speaking or showing any parts of their faces or bodies outside of their homes. Within their homes, they cannot sing or read if they can be heard by strangers outside.
In our view, the situation amounted to gender persecution, already recognized as a crime against humanity, and that we also thought that it amounted to gender apartheid.
Dr. Dorothy Estrada is a member of the UN Working Group on Discrimination Against Women and Girls. Gender apartheid is a term used by many of the speakers, and Dr. Estrada is one of the people working towards having it recognized as such by the international community. But what is being done by the international community regarding Afghanistan? The case against Afghanistan has been taken to the International Criminal Court by 4 countries, supported by 20 others, for violations of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, a case that could end up at the International Court of Justice.
For all the people, and especially the women, who have spoken up in the media, at the Human Rights Council, and in other platforms to say, please do more than condemn, please do something practical, that at last, in the last few months, there has been some practical action on accountability started at least.
A recent milestone achieved this year is the arrest warrants issued by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court for the supreme leader of the Taliban and the Chief Justice.
I think these actions give hope. They also send a message to other members of the international community that normalization or recognition of the Taliban is much too early.
But worries were expressed that the power global institutions might have may become even more limited in the near future.
Also, these are not normal times because the International Criminal Court is under unprecedented attack. Well, precedented the last time the Trump administration was in power because they also imposed sanctions on the ICC then. But there certainly is enormous pressure. Whether that plays into the Afghanistan situation, I don't know.
And again, we're looking at the situation of Afghanistan within the global context. Earlier, we heard Mr. Bennett speak of a global rollback on women's rights. Dr. Estrada of the UN echoed his sentiments. Gender equality, she said, was under attack in many fundamentalist authorities, and this was no coincidence.
We see, and we are seeing all over the world, how gender inequality is so crucial to perpetuating structures of power. And this is very evident in the case of the Taliban, but we should see it also as this continuum. And this is why it is so crucial to reaffirm gender equality and place human rights of women and girls at the center of any of our reflections on Afghanistan, but also on women and girls worldwide, because this is a test to the multilateral system.
But even within the tenuous international landscape, another speaker, Dr. Orzala Nemat, spoke beyond the military prowess of foreign powers. The systematic dismantling of Taliban thinking is happening on the ground in Afghanistan. Women and girls, Dr. Orzala insisted, have not stopped or surrendered to this group.
Yes, they are banned. Yes, the law of PVPV or so many other restrictions are continuing to be coming from the top leadership of Taliban. But also do not forget that women and girls in Afghanistan, and even men in Afghanistan who have women and girls in their houses, who are ready to read, who are ready to get educated, who are ready to continue their knowledge gaining, have not stopped, have not surrendered to this rule.
The bravery and resilience of Afghani women was put at the forefront of this 12th Herat Security Dialogue. Marzieh Hamidi is an Iranian-born Afghan Taekwondo athlete who has lived in France as a refugee since 2021.
I do not ask for sympathy. I demand action. Recognize gender apartheid for what it is. Stop legitimizing a regime that treats women as subhuman. Refuse to let the world move on while Afghanistani women disappear. Because let me be clear, until Afghanistani women are free, neither am I and neither is the world.
And though Marzieh Hamidi's is just the story of one woman, it is the reflection of many.
You're listening to the English language broadcast of Spanish National Radio. Spanish cuisine is well known and appreciated all over the world, but this success did not happen overnight. Gastronomy in the Iberian Peninsula has been changing and evolving for centuries, and now an exhibition gives us a look into what it was like in the Middle Ages. The oldest cookbook in Spain is being exhibited for the first time ever in the exhibition Medieval Gastronomy, El Libro de Sensovi and the Cuisine in the 14th and 15th Centuries. Medieval history professor Juan Vicente García Marcilla was in charge of curating this exhibition and is joining us now. Juan Vicente, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
The exhibition is currently running in the University of Valencia. Juan Vicente, tell us about the Llibre de Sensoví, the Book of Sensoví. What is it? Why is it so important?
Well, the Sensoví is a 14th century cookbook containing 72 recipes. And it is important because it's the oldest in Spain and one of the oldest in Europe to be written in the language of the country, in this case in Valencian and not in Latin, which tells us about the expansion of a gastronomic culture and of books in the language spoken by the people and not only by the educated minority.
Well, although the copy that is preserved dates back to the 15th century, it is estimated that it was originally written in 1324, which means that this year it would celebrate its 700th anniversary. A piece of history, we could call it. What does the book tell us about gastronomy at the time?
Yeah, well, the first thing it tells us is that there was a very elaborate cuisine, and only made by a specialist, using multiple techniques and ingredients that were both from local and came from far away and provided exotic experiences. It also talks about taste, its relationship with the medical theories of the time, and a constant desire to innovate and to surprise the dinner.
And who was the target of this book? Because I imagine it was not for like the general public, but it was more directed to the upper middle classes, right?
Right. If we look at the recipes and the amount of expensive and exotic ingredients they contain, some with more than 10 different spices, it must be said that this cuisine was not within the reach of just anyone, but only the richest. It is therefore conceivable that this recipe book was written for the cooks of the nobility, the high clergy, or the richest bourgeoisie, and perhaps it was intended so that they themselves could suggest to their cooks what type of preparation they wanted each day. However, this does not mean that it cannot inform us of the most popular cuisine, because the book contains all kinds of recipes, some of which are very simple. So it is very likely that these dishes were also prepared in humble homes, perhaps without any of the ingredients.
You were mentioning that some of these recipes contained more than 10 spices. What ingredients were being used, and how do they differ from the ingredients that we use now, particularly in the Mediterranean cuisine?
Okay. It should be borne in mind, firstly, that America was not known at this time. So the many American ingredients that were incorporated into European cuisine later, such as tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, chocolate, corn, and beans, are not present. But the many that Arabs brought, such as rice, aubergines, artichokes, and sugar, are. As for what they had, they we don't use, it is above all the quantity and variety of spices, which today we associate more with Arab or Indian cuisine. They added cinnamon or ginger to almost anything, something we don't know, we don't do, and even sugar, which could also be used in savory dishes because it was an exotic flavor and was also very expensive due to its scarcity. Thus, a Valencian noble such as the Duke of Gandia, Alphonse the Elder, being the owner of one of the first sugarcane plantations in his manor, boasts about eating lamb chops with sugar.
Interesting. So it was also used as a way to show power. It's very difficult to imagine Spanish cuisine without potatoes, without tomatoes, without peppers. But how about the techniques? Do they differ a lot?
The techniques were already very, very refined. They could saute some ingredients and then cook them with broth, or roast only half of them and then complete the cooking with all the ingredients in recipes such as the one of Miss Rouse, which means half roasted. They used mortar a lot and even strainers. Obviously, they didn't have microwaves or food processors, but their techniques were anything but rudimentary and required great skills.
Well, this cookbook shows us the roots of Spanish gastronomy, but how has it evolved? Can we find any traces of the medieval cuisine included in this book in our current gastronomy? Are there any dishes in the book that we could recognize?
Of course, Spanish gastronomy has evolved a lot due to different influences and, as I said before, due to the emergence of tomatoes and potatoes, which are now so important in our cuisine. Are there still traces of that medieval cuisine? I think so, in the preparations, in the mines and fried food. For example, they are based on the same principles and the ingredients do not vary too much. There are some recipes that we could identify in Sansovie, such as stuffed aubergines, cheese fritters, morteruelo, or something similar to custard that we find in Sansovie too. Other preparations, however, would be totally strange to us.
Well, during this period, the Middle Ages, 14th, 15th century, we can say that gastronomy as a concept gained a lot of popularity. Why was that?
I think that in part, this was due to the greater social mobility that existed in those centuries. New rich people were appearing, especially merchants and bankers, who could oversaddle the traditional elites, such as the nobility. In this way, these traditional elites began to develop ways of differentiating themselves socially that had to do not only with wealth, but with behavior, with savoir-faire, and with taste. And being a gourmet was certainly something that could not be learned overnight. So the presence of taste began to be explored as a form of distinction.
Juan Vicente García Marcilla, curator of the exhibition Medieval Gastronomy. El Llibre de Sansovie was written in the region of Valencia, but the prologue says something different, right? What is it? Why did they write that?
Yes. In the prologue, it tells us that the book was written by a squire of the King of England called Pere Felipe, no less than in 1024. Obviously, it is false. This will take us to pre-Norman England, to the court of Knut the Great, where, of course, there was no squire with that name. More than half of the ingredients mentioned were not known, nor were many of the techniques. Why did they do it? This type of fake news was common at the time as a kind of marketing operation. Attributing the book to an ancient royal court, in addition to exotic England, land of King Arthur, and many legends, gave the product a plus. In the same way that a work as Valencian as Tirant lo Blanc sometime later would turn the protagonist into an English knight.
Interesting. And do we know anything about the author? Are there any theories about who could have written it?
We really don't know it. Although there are some theories, too risky for me, that have even attributed it to the Valencian doctor Arnau de Vilanova, at a time when medical dietetics and cooking were closely related. But it's only a hypothesis that it's impossible to prove.
And are there any precedents for this book in our country? Anything that we know of?
Not exactly precedents, but there are quite a few cookbooks throughout Western Europe at this time. There were some in Al-Andalus before, but from the end of the 13th century, we find books in Italy, such as the Liber de Coquina, in France, the Viandier de Tejovan, or in England, such as the Form of Curie. And even in Denmark, we have a very old one. Many of these books even sell recipes as if a kind of international cuisine had been created that identified the European elites. In the case of the Crown of Aragon, there are currently three other books identified in Catalan, written between the end of the 14th century and the end of the 15th century. However, we do not have a real recipe book in Spanish. And it is curious that the first cookbook in Spanish that was printed was a translation of the Catalan Llibre del Coq, translated as Libro de Guisados, Manjares y Potajes, Book of Stews, Delicacies and Potages.
The book El Llibre de Sansovie is being exhibited for the first time. Now, we have mentioned that they were using a lot of spices, a lot of sugar, which is something that people might find surprising. But are there any specific recipes that people would not expect?
Yes. For me, the most surprising recipe is how to cook a peacock without having its head or tail feathers removed so that they look good on the table. Mm-hmm. For them, the entire animal is plucked except for those parts, which are wrapped in linen bandages, which must be constantly wet so that they don't burn. Then they are removed and the feathers are open again.
Interesting, very interesting. Has someone tried to recreate some of these recipes that you know of?
Yeah, in the second part of our exhibition, there are three recipes that are put into actuality, into nowadays, into a nowadays vision. Uh-huh. But not this of the peacock.
Well, now, since you mentioned the exhibition, let's dive into the exhibition itself. It is divided in three parts. The first one mm-hmm. is called Cuisine to Read, the recipe books and its ingredients. What can we find in this section?
Yeah, in the first part of the exhibition, it features Sensovia's own book as the protagonist, as well as some of its siblings, other cookbooks containing similar recipes, as well as banquet account books, a medical treatise, and a whole series of ingredients that appear from jars and other containers of wine, oil, or wheat, to the remains of those foods themselves, such as a whole 15th century egg that someone drank by making a hole in the bottom of it and throwing the entire sail into the vaults of the Church of Santa Maria of Alicante, where he was working, probably, together with other remains of food that are also in the exhibition, such as grape eggs, olives, peaches, or almonds.
Well, this section is followed by medieval stoves, the kitchen as a working and creative space. What have you included here?
Yes, in this second section, we have the kitchen itself, all the instruments that were in it, from mortars to stoves, pots and pans, as well as a waffle iron, a kind of large tongs that were heated on the fire and acted like the waffle molds of today. And in this section, as I have said before, my collaborator Andrea Marti also reproduces in a video three of the recipes that appear in Sensovia.
Mm-hmm. Which are these recipes?
It's a recipe of rabbit, another of one kind of custard, and the three is the staff of Virginis.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last section is eating together in the Middle Ages, the universe of the table. Was it common in this period to sit around a table to eat?
Well, it can be said that it was precisely in the late Middle Ages that people began to sit down and eat together around the table. You must think that the Romans did not sit at the table. They lay down next to it in their triclinia, and the Muslims ate on the floor. However, from the 11th century onwards, the custom of having a higher table and eating sitting on chairs spread in the West. From then onwards, eating together was a sign of good relations, of friendship, and even of sharing a life project. In this section, we have all the tableware, both for everyday and for banquet use, and also the cutlery, with the presence of the first forks that arrived in Spain through Valencia in the mid-15th century. We have also reproduced a tinaj or sideboard from the period, a piece of furniture that was made with step shelves, where the best tableware in the house was displayed, which was usually made of gold-plated ceramic from Manises. Here we also have some Gothic panels from the 15th century depicting medieval banquets and some exceptional pieces such as crystal glasses from the period, the chalice attributed to the Borgia Pope Alexander VI, or a naveta, a container made from a large sea snail and silver decorations that make it look like a sailing ship from the Cathedral of Zaragoza. These containers were used to contain spices, as would be the case, or if they were larger, to leave the leftovers of the meal in them that were then distributed among the servants.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just to wrap up, what do you hope visitors take away from this exhibition?
Well, I think the most important thing I would like visitors to understand at this exhibition is to see the Middle Ages not as a dark and barbaric period, but as a very sophisticated moment of history, as seen here in the case of food, a period that left us many important legacies, and that is why it is worth knowing and appreciating it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the exhibition Medieval Gastronomy, El Libre de Sansovie and the Cuisine in the 14th and 15th Centuries will run until the 25th of May in the University of Valencia. Juan Vicente García Marcilla, curator and medieval history professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast. You've been listening to the English language broadcast of Spanish National Radio, where we bring Spain to you through shortwave.
With Amy Egan
and Marilyn Quintana.
Today we have had help from sound technician Elias Cody.
And production help from Cristina Dorado.
We thank you for listening and hope you tune in again for future broadcasts.